There's a lot to take on there, and therefore a lot to let go of subsequently.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking of, like, Medisec. It's like a 6-year program. And I was sitting in the train, and I was sitting in front of two undergraduate graduates, and they were there, and I was saying to the other, this is not a medicine. There's a lot of cramming of information, which, according to when you read what Sidney Banks and Eckhart Tolle say, is the opposite of what we've been hearing.
I know. This is an unlearning. It's not a learning.
Yeah.
It's an unlearning.
And you don't want to let go of something you're familiar with, and what you're familiar with, you feel more secure with.
Up to a point.
Yeah, I guess, but, you know.
You only have to scratch the surface to see that level of security is wafer thin.
But you relate to that insecurity in a way, like
it's
you
familiar.
Identify with it, so you're okay with it.
Yeah.
I'm okay, although it's, as soon as you let go of it, it's,
yeah.
You realise that, you know, it's just, it's a burden.
There wasn't much to it, really, yeah.
But you just still go through it.
It's quite flimsy. Yeah, whereas there's a much deeper level of security that comes naturally, which is not reliant on knowledge. It's not reliant on believing in something. It's contingent upon being connected with that bigger source of wisdom, which we've all got. Once you get into the flow of that, into the connection of that, there's no substitute for that. You know, there's nothing that you can learn as a body of material that will give you that same sense of security.
Ian, though, that depends to the depth to which you have your realizations done as well.
That's true.
You know, I think for some people the depth is so great there is never going back.
I'd say that's true for all of us.
Yeah.
Even if you've only seen it a little bit, there's no going back.
I don't know.
There isn't. It's a slippery slope. We're all doomed. See, even people who get a glimpse and then they seem to go back, it's irrevocable. It's irrevocable. It's like the genie's out of the bottle and it's going to niggle away at them.
Yeah, I think I just thought that. You know, often it's sort of get tied up in certain things.
Yeah.
I just thought that.
Yeah.
It's just the thinking, and try to justify it by saying, yeah, but, you know, playing a game with, you know, situations, or having to speak in a certain way that they understand, people understand. And then thinking, actually, I just give a gobshot, really.
Yeah.
And wait for them to do their talking.
Yeah.
It's interesting, so it is a bit schizophrenic actually, because you know you want to say, I just think this, like with my housing things, I'm still ongoing, blah blah blah, but I'm still having to play a talking game with the police and my housing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a practical example of old thinking, old thoughts, but it's created a situation. I'm still having to play. It's like politics, really. We're playing their game in order to get safety.
For as long as you have to do that. Yeah,
yeah, just for the time. And
yeah.
I know it's just for the time.
Yeah.
Because it's just my thinking.
Yeah.
I've done it.
And there'll be a point where you realise you don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
It's finished. It's complete.
And it's soon.
Yeah.
Can you do it with a detachment that you're looking at yourself doing it?
Yeah, it's funny.
Well,
to be
that's what this has brought to me anyway, that,
yeah.
You know, so
yeah,
you don't have to get, you don't have to go right into the,
no,
you can say, oh yes,
yeah,
and
I
still
have to
on the surface they can see the same,
yes,
but for you the experience is hopefully different.
It is different, and that's what I'm aware of, that's what I'm calm about it, mostly calm about it.
That's good that you're seeing that, because that's, you know, that's, some people often have that initial response to this is, well, yeah, but I've still got X, Y, and Z to sort out. You know, I've still got to take care of my kids. I've still got to do so and so and so and so. I can't just let all that go. And that may well be true. You know, we've all got different jobs and responsibilities and so forth. And at the same time, your relationship to that can change 180 degrees. That's the bit that we don't see. Which means you can still be performing the same acts for as long as you need to do that, but from doing it from a completely different place within yourself, it doesn't take anything like the same toll on you. Something that could have been very draining or very frustrating or very intense could be just, it's just something that I'm doing, and I'm just doing it as a means to an end until I don't have to do it anymore.
Mm.
Which, you know, it's a very different place to be in.
Mm.
Even though from the outside nothing's changed, you're still in the same situation.
Yeah.
But on the inside, that's what really counts.
And so totally, I say totally, well, no, it's totally, because it's in there, like you say, can't undo it, but that thing of, oh, when I've got a nice house or a place to live or a safe place or so, then I'll be okay.
Yeah.
I say, look, when I go on holiday, I don't think, oh, this bed's a bit uncomfortable. When I get the new bed, another bed tomorrow, I'll be, you may do, you think, okay, I'll go and lie on the beach instead while I'm camping. So it's just for today, you know.
Yes.
I'll keep it in today, that's the other thing too, isn't it? Am I safe tonight? Am I warm tonight?
Yeah.
Thank you very much, you know, universe, whatever.
That's it, exactly, yeah. In this moment, am I okay?
Yeah.
Yes or no? And it's surprising how often we are.
Yeah.
When we think we're not.
Yes. Well, we don't want to be for a reason.
But this is actually one of the things that I wanted to talk about this weekend was the and it'll have lots of resonances with things that you've come across already. Like, for example, with Eckhart Tolle's material, Power of Now. It's become a popular idea in the collective consciousness. This idea of being present. And that recognition that a lot of apparent problems and difficulties cease to exist when we live in the present. They only exist when we take ourselves out of the present moment. So if I start going into an imaginary future, like you're saying, thinking, well, you know, I will be okay if or when, but right now I can't be, then I lose my peace of mind, I lose my well-being, even though my situation is actually okay. It's okay as it is. And similarly, if I drag something along with me from the past and I say, I can't be okay until that's completely resolved, or until that person apologizes to me, or until I learn to forgive, or until whatever it is, whatever condition I attach to it, then again, it looks like something real is taking away my sense of well-being. But once you see it for what it is, you realize that it doesn't exist. You'll hear this said, the past and the future doesn't exist. But this is one of the things that will start to get clearer and clearer to you. As you deepen in your understanding of three principles, you'll see that that is absolutely true, is that it only exists in the realm of thought. So whatever's happened yesterday, 5 minutes ago, 10 years ago, it has got no further hold on any of us, except to the degree that we're still thinking about it. And that's crazy, isn't it? When you start to see the implications of that, it's very, very freeing. It's very liberating. Just that one piece of this understanding can completely liberate somebody from a lifetime of suffering.
It's completely life-changing.
Yeah. That's where the truth is. It's in the moment. That's the only place you ever see it.
It's just the most powerful thing. But it's quite gentle. That's
yeah, it's
really
subtle, that's
really
it.
Really weird.
Yeah.
It just seeps and it's lovely. But it's as obvious as nothing's happened, but everything has.
That's it.
Mm. But that's the highest form of homeopathic healing as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you take the remedy and you nothing's been done.
That's right.
There's been a change.
That's right. And you even forget why you went to the homeopath. You know, you forgot what you were complaining about last time.
Because
it's gone.
Once it's gone, then you've forgotten it. And then each time
it
reminds you.
You go, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I did complain about that every day for 15 years. Isn't that funny? And the peculiar thing is that it's as if it never existed.
Yeah.
Which is actually true. Because it never did. That's why we can let go of things so amazingly quickly when that happens. It's because it never really existed, except in our own thinking. If it really was a real problem, it would have taken a lot more to get rid of it, to have it go away. But that's why things can shift so rapidly and so easily. It's because we're seeing through the illusion in that moment. We're actually seeing that what we thought was real wasn't.
What I'm also finding is that whenever I'm negative about anything, it's always because I'm comparing to something.
Yes.
Or it's in the past, or it's in the future.
Yeah.
And it's all about, it's never about the moment, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
There's always that, and then when I look at each thing that way, if I, many times you go up and down in the day and whenever, but when I look at it each time and I think, well, actually that's only because I'm comparing.
That's it.
Or I'm thinking about something in the past.
Yeah.
Or something in the future.
Yeah.
There's no point. And that sort of negativity doesn't last.
Yeah. It doesn't have the same hold on you once you see it for what it is.
Yeah.
That's it. And we've each got our own brand. You know, we've each got our own brand of, you could call negativity or judgmental thinking, critical thinking, which takes us away from well-being in the moment. So we've got our own flavour of that which we've habitually preferred. But essentially it's the same. The nature of it is the same. That's the kind of thinking that I would use to take me away from peace of mind. You'd have your version, Debbie would have her version. But underneath that, we're all doing the same thing. We're all using the power of thought in a way which works against us, works against our sense of well-being. And that's all we're ever doing. We're all in the same boat. Now, last month, I forgot to give you the reminders, didn't I? I brought them in with me and I took them home again. But did I send it to you in an email?
Yeah, but I managed to delete it, so I'm
glad to. Well, I reminded myself to keep them in my bag so that I will bring them this time. Because I wanted to just skip through a few of these with you. Just to see. That jolts in your mind. I'm aware of the fact that these reminders may not bear much relationship to what we actually talked about on the weekend. These are some of the things that I intend to talk about at some point, but the actual sequence doesn't always follow.
Is this the third weekend or the fourth weekend?
Well, this is from last...
Yeah. Is this the third weekend? We're
now on the third weekend, aren't we? Yeah. So I'll give you that one tomorrow.
No. I didn't know anyone was third or fourth.
But I just wanted to visit this one briefly with you. And just have a scan through it and see what jumps out at you. So, or anything that triggers a thought or an insight or a question or a comment, anything that you want to share from your own experience. Personality is neither continuous nor consistent.
I have to actively maintain it, do I?
Yeah.
Acting. That's what I feel like half the time. I'm acting like what I should do, how I should behave today,
yes,
in order to keep
keep people happy,
uh-huh.
or push them away usually,
yeah.
in some form or other, or that's just sort of social interaction, just say, I'm going to be civilised today,
yes.
and if I get upset, I'm not going to say anything. Because it just, unless I want to punish them, or push them away, or control them in some way,
mm-hmm.
but I'm still aware of the tricks. And
yeah. Well, what it comes down to, essentially, what we call personality, is my chosen image of myself. That's all it is. It's the image of myself that I choose to believe in, and therefore think that I have to maintain in order to get by. Yeah. And what does that consist of? Thought. It's just thought. That's. That's why it's neither continuous nor consistent.
Okay. So this isn't true, actually. That's why I'm going, what? It doesn't.
Which bit isn't true?
I just feel that it doesn't belong there somehow.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Now that's what I asked you to notice, was any that jumped out
yeah.
at you. So.
I had a very interesting conversation with somebody a few days ago. And we were talking about three principles, and he has done a lot of. He's into Sufism, and he's done a lot of.
Uh-huh.
He's been to a lot of. I've done a lot of things, a lot of repeats, a lot of whatever. And as I was explaining this, it was very interesting. Isn't that one of the best evenings I've had in a long time? But he asked about specifically that, as he said, but if this is true, if this is what it really is, and you start getting into it, then you kind of cease to exist.
Mm-hmm.
My identity, where does that go?
Mm.
Well, it's there. Something else was working through you, is what I had said. Like, you know, I was trying to explain that that's what happens, is the thought quietens, then something else is at work, something else is coming through, and chi related to, which is exactly what he is actually studying with Sufism and whatever as well.
Yes.
But it was that idea as well that feels a bit strange, because you don't know where your identity goes. It's like as I was thinking about it, I had difficulty also in a way letting go of what I thought my identity was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it feels like, so where do you
begin and end?
So where then, who are you? You know, all your ideas about yourself, then, you know,
mm-hmm.
where does that lead you? Like, should I make something else that I enjoy and then go with that? Or, you know what I mean? Like, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. It leaves an apparent void, doesn't it? An apparent void.
Mm.
But that's all it is.
But that's something I've noticed, is this void.
Say again?
The void.
Yes.
And I don't know what to do. I know I don't have to do anything about it, but it's like there's nothing there.
Yes.
What's a void?
Maybe there is something in a void that, but I just, for me, that I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So I find it a very difficult place to be.
Mm.
In my thoughts. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
You
but,
see,
but the thing is, I want to fill it with something. That's
right.
The temptation, of course.
Very much. We have a trinity here. Okay. This is how Sid Banks articulated it. So I'm going to stick with this model for the time being. Mind, consciousness, thought. Now, if we start to see that whatever we've taken ourselves to be up until this point consists largely of thought, whatever I've taken myself to be, in other words, that conditioned personality, some people would call it the ego, the sense, the self-image. So that sense of self which we've all adopted, when you start to see into its actual nature, you'll see that what it consists of is thought. Now, what have we already learned about the nature of thought?
It's fleeting.
It's fleeting. It's impermanent. It's ever-changing. And it comes out of nothing and it returns to nothing. There's nothing to it of any substance. It cannot ever be continuous. It has no lasting form. It has no permanence. No thought does. There's an illusion of continuity which is created because we think habitually. We think of ourselves as being a certain way on a daily basis. But if we were to stop thinking that way on any particular day, it literally ceases to be. We cease to be that way. That's what happened to Sid Banks when he had his overwhelming realization. He stopped being the shy, insecure, socially awkward person that he'd been all his life, literally overnight. The next day he wasn't that anymore, which showed him that that was never real. He was never that person. That wasn't his personality. It looked like it was, but it wasn't. And I've already seen this.
It
which
is your person, sorry to interrupt.
Go on.
It is your personality. Can it still change every night?
If it is, did you say?
Yeah. So you said it wasn't his personality, but if it had been his personality.
Well, I suppose we should.
Are we saying no one's got a personality and it changes? Yes.
What we're saying is personality just equals
your
thought.
Yeah. Okay, so you're.
Or his perception of
Now, what we know about thought also is that when thought is activated through the powers of mind and consciousness, what happens to it? It takes on the form of reality for whoever is the thinker in that moment. So on the one hand we're saying it's not real because it's just thought, but we have to bear in mind that that's how we experience reality, is through the vehicle of thought. So it's going to seem real to us even though we know it's not. Right? That's the paradox again. We can see that the nature of it is such that it cannot be real. It's not permanent. It's completely transient. It's fickle. It's always going to be subject to change. So there's nothing real and substantial about it. And at the same time, whatever I'm thinking about myself, just as whatever I'm thinking about the world, in the moment, that's what's going to seem real to me. It's the only reality I've got. However, what these principles point us back to is the place where thought arises from. So there's a place where thought arises from, and we could speculate, returns to. It comes out of nothing, it goes back into nothing. But that nothingness is what we call the intelligence of mind, the intelligence behind all life. So that, you could say, that's what's left in the absence of this. I don't identify with that stream of thinking that's coming through consciousness on a daily basis. If I don't identify with that, even though it's still happening, what happens is I start to rest more in this from which it comes and goes.
I felt as recently, what I've been feeling is I'm actually enjoying watching. I'm enjoying thinking. And I realise that I don't want my thinking to completely go. I enjoy thinking.
You can't stop it anyway, so
it's actually fun sometimes to, you know, just see where it takes you and make connections. I enjoy thinking.
But listen to what you said, the first thing that you just said there. I enjoy watching my thinking.
Hmm.
Right? Now, if you're watching your thinking, who's the one that's doing the watching?
The consciousness, I suppose. Or the consciousness, no? Or your whatever, you.
That's the thing to look at.
Mm.
Who's the one that's actually seeing the play of thought and consciousness? Who's that one?
Mm.
What you just start to see is that that's the one that remains. That's the one that has a continuity, that has a permanence to it. That's the one that's not changing. There's that aspect of us which is mind-consciousness combined. So it's the flow of, you could call it the flow of the bigger intelligence, but it's combined with this feature which we humans have of actually being self-aware in the moment of whatever's coming through us. So that gift that we've been given, we can experience that. We can experience it directly.
It's like Eckhart Tolle said when he had his awakening.
Yeah.
The sentence was, I can't live with myself.
I can't live with myself, that's it. Yeah.
And then because of, you know, he was at Oxford or Cambridge studying, and it was the ridiculous the sentence.
Yeah.
That mean, must mean there's two of me.
Exactly.
I cannot live with myself.
Yeah. How many
so,
are in there?
yeah. So which is the real? Who is this I and who is myself? And it was that he fell into, if you like, and that what was not real dissipated, and what was real stayed.
That's what remains. Yeah. There's a wonderful sentence, you know that, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the book called A Course in Miracles. Have you seen that? It's been around for quite a while, maybe 30, 40 years now. And it's a very beautiful piece of work. And it, one of the opening paragraphs in that book, it says, nothing real can be threatened, and nothing unreal exists. And therein lies the peace of God. When you see that nothing real can be threatened and nothing unreal exists. So in that context, what would be unreal here? Yeah, the thought is the unreal in that sense. It's the fleeting, it's the transitory. It's the unreal which appears to us to be real in the moment, but it's not actually.
Is it like me, it's like you get to actually see it. It's like you recognise that it was always there.
Yeah.
I think that's why this is easy.
That's it.
You've always had it.
Yes.
And it will never go because that's connected not to sort of the earth or a human experience.
Yeah.
It's much deeper. I don't know what it is.
But it's bigger than you personally.
Far bigger.
Yeah.
And but with this, you get to sense it. I can't really put it into words.
I know, it's hard.
but it is the most sort of blissful thing, isn't it?
Yes.
It is like you've taken some mind-changing drug or something.
Yeah.
Without any side effects.
Yeah, you're opening to a much bigger field of awareness.
You know it's always there, and it always was.
Yeah.
So everything's okay.
That's it. That's what cannot be threatened.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like love. It feels like a very loving thing.
Yes.
And very, I don't know, I can't really say. It's like God.
That's
I've just been pointing to books which are all about God, which is interesting, and I've talked to people about this.
Yeah.
So I've read The Shack. And that sort of was very interesting to read that, and that feeling of the sense of being with God.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and of course God is just a word.
He's just a word.
Right?
Yeah.
Our concept of God. But the word we use, God, or whatever word you choose to substitute, it's referencing to this, what we're talking about, to this bigger intelligence. That's really what the word God is about. It's pointing to that which is behind the phenomenal world which we're experiencing. There's something behind that which we are also part of, which we were never separate from. It just seemed like we were. And there's a lovely sense of ease which you're pointing to, which comes into your life when you start to re-establish that connection.
You also can let go of fear.
Yeah.
Because your destiny is your destiny.
That's it.
Your past is gone. There's really nothing to fear.
There's nothing to fear.
And that's a very powerful thing to have inside you.
Yeah.
Which you really want everybody else to have.
But, this is the great paradox, is that of course when you start to see it, you want to share it, especially with people who you can see are struggling.
Yeah.
And yet the real paradox, and to me the wonder of this, is that everybody has to see it for themselves.
Yes. Yeah. It's quite difficult.
Isn't that? But it's so peculiar, isn't it, that it's kind of, that it's wired that way, is that you cannot force anyone to have an insight. You can't force anybody to wake up to the reality of their own nature. All you can do is be in that yourself to the degree that you're able, and offer a listening space, if you like, which is sufficiently helpful that it enables them to start to see it for themselves or not.
They'll see, hopefully, if it happens with me, but they'll see it reflected from in you.
Yeah.
They think, what's happened?
They get curious.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you've got an opening.
Then,
yeah. Yeah, to share what you see. Yeah. That's, and to me, that's the right way around. You know, rather than going out preaching about it, it's much easier when people get curious. It was like, you seem to have changed. You know, you don't seem to be so anxious. You don't seem to be so worried. What have you been doing? You've got a wonderful opportunity there to share, and you've got someone who's receptive. But if you're trying to convert someone who's not, it's very difficult. It doesn't help.
I've also found it interesting to share it without necessarily being very direct about it.
Yeah, just alluding to it kind of thing. Or
with very simple things. It was interesting to see that can also work. It's just this one couple of days ago, actually. And it's at the hair salon. Who does nails, and not gonna, you know, we're not gonna get into philosophical conversation with the woman. But she's, as with her, she's like, you're very nice. And I said, well, you don't meet a lot of nice people. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I started from there, and she's like, well, yeah, no, most people are all whatever and whatever. I'm like, well, maybe they're just caught up in something, and you know, it's just about really how, don't take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't take them personally, don't take yourself personally. And somehow, and that just went on. And I think all, it was really a 5-minute conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you just completely lifted my mood.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to take anything. And it was just that. It was just
she
a
heard
few
something.
Sentences.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I felt like that's it.
That's it.
That's all that needed to be said
exactly.
There. And there was
yeah.
no mention of anything. I mean,
yeah.
we don't really need to... I mean, it can also be somehow, you can transfer that information in
yeah.
just very simple
yeah. Yeah.
sentence. And I wasn't trying to.
That's what's on, that was what was on your side.
I wasn't trying to.
But that's the key. That's the key to teaching it successfully, is not trying to teach it. Not trying to convince anyone, not trying to put it in a certain way, but... You were just in a space where you were in a good feeling, and you naturally shared what came to you in the moment.
Mm.
That's the best and only way to really teach this.
Mm.
Isn't that cool?
But then I wonder when you set up a program, let's say,
yeah.
as such, where you're expected to teach it. And you're,
well, who says
you know
you're expected?
That's what, you know. I don't know.
And what does expectation consist of? That's all it is. It's just thought.
Yeah.
Other people's, your own. It's just
yeah.
thought. You don't have to take that seriously.
Yeah.
And then you see how freeing that is. So I could set up a program without expectation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Does that mean that people come into it wouldn't have any expectation? No, they will. That's okay.
They will, exactly.
They will. Some will more than others.
Yeah.
You know, just like here. And if someone comes with too much expectation and they see that it's not matching, they might leave.
Yeah.
It's okay. You know, other people who've got a little bit of expectation might realize that that's all it is, and they'll let it go. So they'll stick around. And other people are very willing to drop it at the beginning. They say, well, I don't really know what it's about, but I'm coming with an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always going to be true, no matter what level you aim it at. But it's neat that you saw that, how easy it can be to teach it when you're not trying to teach it.
It was just really a very normal conversation.
That's
not
it.
Even a conversation.
You're just hanging out.
It's just like small
yeah.
talk.
You're just
yeah,
hanging
just
out. But it's not just small talk in the sense that you heard something in what she said to you
mm-hmm.
and you connected with that, and then you kind of used that as a hook to go a little bit deeper, you know, to actually offer something in response to that, which wasn't just the everyday, you know. 'Cause she could have said, you know, you're really nice. You could have said, oh yeah, thank you very much, you know, and added nothing more to it. Or you could have made a joke about it, or, you know, you're pretty nice yourself, or something like that, and that would have been the end of the story. But what you did was you got curious. You know, it's like you got curious about the fact that she said that. Well, you know, the people that you're around, are they not normally nice or something? And it's that curiosity that opens, you know, it's like that means now that you're listening to her in a way that probably a lot of people don't listen. This is one of the things that I've been learning from, you know, the two tutors that I've been training with simultaneous to running this course, Mark Howard and Kathy Casey. And Mark Howard, one of the things that he has really emphasized with us, we spent 3 days on this and nothing else, was listening. Just listening. He said, it's all about your listening. And I had no idea what he was talking about when he first said that, because I wasn't listening. Well, you start to see that mostly what we listen to is our own self-talk. We listen to our own thinking. We don't actually listen to what the other person's attempting to convey. And when you do, you suddenly hear something that's like a revelation. It's like, oh my God, that's what they're saying. That's what they're asking. And when you learn to listen deeply, which is what you did there, without trying, you just did. You heard what was behind what she was saying. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it wasn't what she said, it's what's behind what she was saying. So you're actually hearing behind the words. And that's what Sid Banks, I think, was attempting to say. When he says, don't listen to my words, he would say something like, listen for the feeling. And everybody's like, yeah, well, what feeling? You know, where is it? But what I understood from when he says that, and he says it over and over in his talks, what he's saying is, listen to what's behind the words. What is it that's being conveyed in the silence, if you like, or just in the energy that's behind those words? And if you can start to pick up on that, then when you respond to that, not to the words. And that touches people. Because most people's listening isn't that good. So we just exchange words with each other. My words, your words, someone else's words. But when someone listens behind the words and then they respond to what they heard from behind the words, you respond from that place within yourself to that, it wakens something up. Something gets activated that's in all of us, but it's dormant for much of the time. And everybody responds to that. Everybody likes it. Everybody likes to be truly heard. You know? It's like a healing balm for everyone. So, but the funny thing is, if you see that worked, and you say, okay, I'm going to try that now with everybody. You kill it dead. That's the elusive nature of this. Is the moment you turn it into a doing or a technique, or, you know, it's a model I'm going to apply.
Mm.
That's it, you've lost it. It's an in-the-moment thing. It's something that arises spontaneously, moment by moment. It's great that you saw it. And it's great that it arose in what looks like an everyday situation, because this is one of the things that I realised about this early on, is for most of us, it's an incremental, everyday discovery. That's really what this is. It's not, you know, it's not a blinding flash of enlightenment, which occasionally people have, but mostly it's just something that creeps up on you. Would you say that that's been the case so far?
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of seeps in, and then it's only when you kind of look back and say, oh yeah, wow. Or you hear what other people are saying and you realise that you've made changes that you hadn't even noticed that you've made them. So it does have that subtle quality to it.
The strange thing is that when you were talking about and your identity.
Yes.
And various people saying things about it. When I went to the Brandon Mays journey.
Yeah.
And I went to what I call my really difficult time. I went to a place where I didn't have any thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was frightened.
Mm.
Because I was looking for myself. And I couldn't. You know, it was like I was searching for me, and because it was all identified with thought, I couldn't find myself. And I remember that I had a piece of paper and a pencil, and I drew a dot in there, and then I got a rubber, and I rubbed it out. And I thought to myself, I'm like that dot, I've rubbed it out, but I'm still there.
Right.
And that upset me. that I wanted to cease to be.
Yes.
But I couldn't. And it was a really, I would say, a strange feeling. It was because I was so identified with thought and who I was. That, you know, like other people go into places, the void and the bliss. And, but to me, it felt traumatic because I wanted to, I, you know, like 100%, I wanted to cease to exist.
Hmm.
But like that dot, even the rubber had rotted out, but I knew it's still there.
Hmm.
And that's how it felt.
Hmm. Yeah. So another way that we can express this, this is the form, and this is the formless. And that again, that's the play that we're living in and experiencing. Every moment is something coming into form, which we then experience as our moment by moment reality, and then it's returning to that formless place from which it came. And the formless, again, this is what remains. This is what's permanent. This is where your true security lies. This again is paradoxical. Because we look for our security in the form. So we look for it in a job, or we look for it in a certain way of being, or we look for it in a partner, or we look for it in an amount of money, or we look for it in a certain physique or a certain lifestyle. Or this is all different forms. We don't realize that every form is transient. It's all impermanent. But that which it's all coming from, that's what remains. When all of this comes and goes, there's something which, although it's formless, it's actually reliable and it's consistent. It just happens to be formless.
Dean?
Go on.
There's an interesting thing, because lately, and I've noticed this, I felt I have more fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me, this would relate to maybe the death of, I don't know, but I've been feeling it recently. I never really had that. It was okay, but I never really felt so, I don't know if it's appreciative of life, because I'm really, I see how beautiful this all is, and it's all a wonderful expression, and I'm enjoying it, maybe. But there's also a fear of death, and going to that, what I'm wondering is it resistance to letting, is it related to what we're doing here? This is the formless we're starting to connect to.
Yeah.
Well, form is death essentially what dies us, the form.
Yeah, that's it. And it doesn't just die once.
Well, apparently, yeah.
It dies moment by moment.
So I don't know if anybody's experienced that as well.
Yes.
While learning about this, I don't know.
Yeah. It's not uncommon. And not just learning this, but anybody who goes through a kind of inner transformation where your old sense of self starts to crumble, starts to fall away. What I noticed, this goes back to my homeopathy days, was that anybody who goes through that kind of a transition, very often they might start having images or thoughts or even dreams that are death-related coming into their consciousness. For a period.
I've had experiences that are,
yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe it wasn't so exaggerated, but in my head there was this idea of...
Yeah. Yeah, and some people even become suicidal. They start to take that thinking seriously, and they start to really put a lot of energy into it. Then it can even be a suicidal thought that starts to get entertained.
It's not so much suicidal that I'm experiencing, it's just the fear.
Yeah, yeah.
The fear of dying, which I've never really had issues with before.
Yeah. Keep that in mind, that nothing real can be threatened.
Yeah.
And nothing unreal exists. That's the paradox. That which has been born and dying moment by moment, it's unreal.
Mm-hmm.
It's illusory in that sense. You know, we're each creating every moment of every day. We're creating our own reality, and then it's dying, and we're recreating it, and it's dying. It's coming into form, it's going out of form. And all that's happened is that we've been led to believe, and we've also led ourselves to believe, that some of that form is real. That some of it we've latched onto is, no, that's not impermanent, that's who I am. That's my personality, that's my character, that you can't take that away. We've given it a sense of reality which it doesn't actually have. We've invested it with a sense of permanence which it doesn't have. So when we start to see through that, there's usually a period where it feels a bit shaky. And that will show up differently for different people as well. Some people will start to see that and go, well, without that, what would I be? You know, I'll cease to exist, there'll be nothing left. Some other people will start to get a sense of fear around that. Some people will start to get start to want to cling on to it quite more strongly. You know.
Waves of sorrow, I've had.
Some people will have a grieving, yeah, like a sadness and a grief.
Washing over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's also
because grief, grief and death go together. That's it's the response to loss.
Eaten.
You've been eaten.
Huh? I woke up and actually woke myself crying out.
Yeah.
It was so scary.
Yeah.
I got stuck in the desert a couple of days
ago. It was in the desert.
The crows coming in. You know. Like, no. Don't do that.
Not yet.
So that's where the
it's the grieving for what you thought was real.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I
think it was that realization that it part of me just, you know, it was facing that truth that even though I wanted to cease to be, I still am.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember frantically rubbing the paper.
Yeah.
And knowing that I was still there.
Yeah.
The dot.
Yeah.
And I think that's, yeah, that can be big. And I think that's what's happening to you guys, is that personality.
It's starting to unravel.
It's a, yeah.
Yeah.
It's starting.
Yeah.
The real you being revealed.
Yeah.
But the fear is that there is no real you, like you say.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's it. And that's, you know, that's just a transition, if you like. As you're going through that transition stage, it can be for some people, an insecure feeling or a fearful feeling, or a feeling of, some people will have a kind of despair around it. What's the point? You know, if none of it's real, some people get, it becomes a kind of existential kind of thing. So each person will have their own, again, flavour of that, their own response to it. But the essential underlying process is the same. It's a shedding of that which you took to be true, which actually isn't.
You can have a laugh at it as well.
Well, that's the nice side of it, is when you see through it,
oh,
and you,
yeah,
you actually, you actually see the, you see the funny side. God, have I been living out of that? You know,
yeah.
I've been taking that seriously.
I prefer to have a laugh at it.
Yeah.
It's I think it's ironic or paradox or something, whatever the word is.
Yeah. Well, and it is. There's a cosmic joke in there somewhere, if you can see it.
Yeah.
It is funny.
I feel better for laughing
rather
than crying, although crying is very satisfactory as well.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a feeling and that's just a thinking and it'll go. You don't laugh. Somebody tells you a joke and you don't laugh all day.
That's right.
Stupid,
it also comes and goes. Yeah. But you see, even though we're talking about a kind of a natural process here, that process will also give rise to a thought response. So if you start to get fearful, that's thought too. And seeing that that's all it is, that also helps you. You just keep that on your side, the fact that you know, even if you're getting scared, there's only one place that fear can be coming from. Scary thoughts.
I this is strange, I don't know if that's possible, but it's like also there's a part of your brain or part of your that's getting used to that idea, that needs to get used to this idea
Yeah.
before it completely
Yeah.
gives in,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah, we have to let it in to a certain degree.
Mm.
Yeah, and usually we do that gradually, or we do it partially at first, and then we let it in a bit more. We kind of relax into it. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good way of putting it, kind of getting used to the idea. I think that's accurate.
There was the, I was rereading Growing on the Right Side of the Brain. It's supposed to be the teaching parts of it. But, and as I was reading it also, it was very interesting because I saw so much of the principles in it, the right and left side, it doesn't matter which side, but the idea that you give the very logical linear side of your brain difficult tasks to do,
yes,
things that it cannot,
yes,
it actually will find so difficult to do that it will open up, that it will let go,
yeah,
to that other kind of,
yeah,
happy
yeah,
side. And this was interesting, and I feel like this is part of it also. It's almost like you're giving information that cannot possibly be, I mean, in the beginning the resistance is almost that other left side of the brain,
that's,
you know,
right,
and then it's,
yeah,
you're giving it things that it cannot possibly comprehend, that it will need to give in eventually.
Exactly.
It's
exactly.
Just almost convincing it to slowly let go.
You're right, yeah. You see, anybody who's trying to get their head around this is in for a hard time, because you can't. It's full of paradox, and the logical brain hates paradox. It wants things to be a certain way. It has to be either this or that. It can't be both. And that's, the further deeper into it you go, the more you see the whole thing is paradoxical. It doesn't make any rational sense. So you're right, it kind of eventually it forces you to give way. It forces that part of your mind to give way. Something bigger.
And I'm wondering whether that's where kind of rituals come in, you know, like or meditation or whatever. Not that I'm, you know, what I love about this is it doesn't give you, you know, you're not teaching the,
it's not required,
way.
Yeah.
But I'm also seeing where it can be useful,
yes,
because with this knowledge, knowing that now if you meditate or,
yeah,
pray, whatever it is, that whatever ritual you choose to, or thing doing you choose to do, maybe that's actually what it is. It's kind of an exercise to allow that part of,
mm-hmm,
you to just quieten down a little.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'm...
You see the value of it. Then,
I see more value in it now than I did before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're pointing to. I think it's a good point. For me, the purpose of a ritual really is to turn something, an everyday activity, into a sacred act. That would be my personal definition of the ritual. And I just made that up, that's my own. I didn't steal that from anybody. But, and I first really saw that, I appreciated that more than I ever had when I went to Japan. And because Japanese life is full of ritual, much more so than here. And what I saw there was how so many of the everyday activities of life have been elevated to ritual status, so they become sacred acts. And I saw how that changes. It doesn't change the act, but it changes you in the enactment. It changes the person who's performing the act. And that, to me, is what it's about. So, you know, we make a cup of tea. They have tea ceremony. Right? It's not about making tea. I clock this quite quickly, and then you look around and you see, oh, wow, you know, they bring that same sensibility to so many things.
But it's where it's taught from, because,
yeah,
I have issues with, you know, our rituals or whatever, praying. This year I haven't been praying, I haven't been fasting, and I'm not, you know, holding on to it at the moment at all. But it's because I've been taught it from a different place.
Yeah, it's something that you have to do.
This is something you have to do.
Exactly.
In order to go to heaven.
Right.
You know, why is that? You know, it's not a...
That's what I call...
It's a very different
thing. I call it an empty ritual.
Yeah.
It's empty because it doesn't have the potency, which it was designed to have originally. It just becomes it's an automatic act, you know, which you're performing,
mm-hmm,
because someone else told you it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, that you may as well not do it, you know.
Yeah, that's...
It doesn't convey the value of a true ritual. But the true ritual is that which it arises out of your own seeing. And out of that seeing, that changes your relationship to other people, and it changes your relationship to life, so it changes your relationship to the activities of your life. And in that sense, anything can be a ritual. I love the story of Joseph Campbell, who was one of the teachers that really inspired me for a long time. He was a great mythologist, so he was a scholar. You know, he spent his day in books, you know, and studying the myths and legends of the world. But he had this presence, you know, people, anybody that met him, they knew he had real insight. It wasn't just head knowledge, you know, it wasn't just intellect. Someone asked him once, Mr. Campbell, do you have a meditation practice? He said, yes, I do. He wasn't giving anything away. So would you mind sharing what it is? He said, yes. He said, I like to underline sentences in books. That, to me, when I heard that, that he said that, I was like, that's a true ritual. See, that's a true meditation also.
Yes.
Because it's his, right? No one told him to do that. He's operating in the field which is his field. That's what he does anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he loves to do. But he made it into a sacred act. So for him, underlining sentences in books, that was his meditation. I love that. Because it shows you it can be anything.
Yeah,
it really can be anything. It's not, there's nothing special about, to me, there's nothing special about sitting on the floor in a certain way, pointing in a certain direction, doing something a certain number of times. All of that to me is just superstition.
I think it's in the understanding of the observer as well, and the intention and the way that it's been actually performed, because you can watch somebody do something and get a completely different sense of it, whereas somebody else doing the same thing
wouldn't
get the same feeling.
Yeah, you're right, because of the spirit that they're bringing to it.
The spirit. It's like if he was underlining those sentences, there was a certain spirit connected with that.
And
that's what I, you know, came to mind about the three principles, because I was recalling what I had heard in the conference. And I think one of the most important things that I haven't heard anywhere else is that when you are practicing as a practitioner, one, where are you coming from?
Right.
And two, that you're already seeing the innate health in that individual.
In the other, yes.
And I haven't heard that anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that is specifically unique to the three principles, because I went over the things that you said, and I said, well, Eckhart Tolle and all these other people talk about thought.
Mm.
They talk about thought creating your reality. They talk about being in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, as Sid Banks has called it mind, somebody else may call it presence or awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that the three principle practitioners do is they're coming from that place when they do it, and they're already talking to the innate and well person within the other. And to me, that is unique.
Well,
I haven't seen that anymore.
I know. It is, except where it isn't. And you see, if you go back, you know that little book called The Tao of Homeopathy?
I'll say you said a lot of things in there.
You go back to that book with this in mind, what you just said. What's that book about? It's not about homeopathy. It's about where the person does it from.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
That's what I was saying to you, that, you know, where you've seen things before, suddenly they start coming
together. So when I go back now, if I read some of the Taoist stuff which inspired me 25, 30 years ago, when I read it now, I think I'm reading three principles. I'm not reading Taoism anymore. It's like, geez, that's three principles.
It doesn't matter what you call it. You're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
As Sid Banks himself said,
truth is truth.
Truth is truth. You can go to any teacher and you will see it.
Exactly.
Mm.
But only when you've got the eyes to see it and the ears to hear it.
Yeah.
Because if you haven't, then what you hear is a dogma. You know, it's just somebody else's theory. This is what I like in this conversation, is what Sarah's also pointing to, is she was seeing for herself suddenly, there might be a value in ritual, something that I'd previously discounted because it was something that had become automatic, or it was something that was prescribed for me. It doesn't have its potency, it's lost its value. But suddenly she's starting to see, but there could be a value in it. And it has to do with where you do it from. What's the consciousness that you bring to it, which is the same thing that you're seeing. That's what makes something, to me, that's what makes it a sacred act. It's not the act in itself. You know Alan Watts, have you ever come across any of his stuff? He was one of the first Westerners. He was an English guy, and he went to Japan, learned Japanese, and he was one of the first people to bring the ideas of Zen Buddhism to the West. And some of his writings are still very powerful.
What's his name?
Watts. No relation.
Yeah.
Alan Watts. And he was contemporary of Joseph Campbell, actually. They had some interesting conversations. But somewhere in one of his talks, he said people think that Zen spirituality is for example, he said, people think that it's thinking about God whilst peeling the vegetables. And he said, that's a mistake. He said, Zen spirituality is to just peel the vegetables.
Take the vanity out of it.
Take the thought out of it.
Also.
It's the fullness of me.
Yes. Take the me out of it.
Yeah, take the me out of it.
That's it. That's it.
Communicating with the fullness in the other.
Yeah. That's it.
Who isn't another?
Who isn't another? It turns out that we're one. That's it. Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what happens. When you take the me, when you're able to take yourself out of it, so you put yourself in touch with that bigger field of which you are, then that enables you to connect with that, and that's what you're seeing. Yeah.
Now, a lot of the... As you're saying this with the vegetables...
Because you hear it all the time growing up, Sufism is all the time,
thinking of God all the time, or remembering God, I'm like, what is that, how can they just constantly,
yeah.
But that makes sense now.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
You realise that it's because it's in everything.
Mm. It's very interesting, when I come to think of it, the way these rituals are done, like prayer, I'll take prayer as an example. It's not written anywhere how you should pray.
Yeah.
At least not in the Quran. It's not there.
Yeah. It's just become that way for reasons unknown.
It's the way it was taught by the Prophet. However, had it meant to be the only way, then it would make sense for it to be written or documented.
Properly prescribed.
But it's not. It's passed on.
It's an interpretation.
And then maybe because I've questioned that before, why isn't it written? If it's then it's not the only way.
You're not supposed to question these things. That's the problem, is that these things become crystallized, they become crystallized in people's minds, and then it's no longer even open to question. It's, why do we do it this way? Because we always have.
This is the way that this person was very enlightened. Said we should do it, we follow, but then that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the when people talk about the word of God, I say, which word is that?
And which God?
Translating from something that was written by somebody in Latin into Greek, into Hebrew, into I said, I don't speak Hebrew.
Yeah.
I don't speak Greek, I don't read Latin. So all you're telling me is secondhand stuff.
At least.
From
the
perspective of controlling.
Yeah.
So, most people don't bother to think. They say, it's the King James Bible. I said, King James what? What did he want to do? Control everybody? I said, we believe that shit.
Yeah.
And maybe I might not be able to wear shit now. But we believe that, we believe it, we take it on as a true thing. And then we act as if we must hate other people because they're doing this behaviour, which was a normal behaviour thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And then I shut up.
But this is great. I mean, what's wonderful in the West, we've gone through that process already of rejecting the gods that were imposed upon us.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody, but by and large, that's what we've done as a culture. We've kind of grown up, if you like. We've rejected the childhood gods that we were given, and people have said no to them. And so consequently now it's said that we live in a largely secular society. But it doesn't stop there. Now that, to me, this is the fun part. The fun just starts there. When you throw out the playground gods, the ones that were imposed upon you, then maybe there might be a time when you live in what looks like a godless world, and some people do live in that. You know, they say, well, it's all just random chance, it's all just mutual selection and natural selection and so on. There obviously is no God. But anybody who spends a little bit of time in self-reflection or studying something like this, it inevitably leads you back. It leads you back, but you're going back with new eyes. You're going back with cleaner eyes, because you were able to throw off what had been imposed on you, if it was, then you have there's a possibility to see for yourself something which you can't see when you're stuck in someone else's dogma.
Which is in fact what every prophet, for example,
that's what
the
saw.
Religions that I know of,
that's what they saw.
They all said, you know, no, these gods.
They all rejected what had been given to them.
In order to introduce
exactly.
God.
Exactly. That's the story of all of them. Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, etc.
It's almost like that process
of a
community reject. It was it's the exact same thing that happened as an internal process growing up. Teenage years, I rejected the whole idea of religion and then went back to it and then but very differently.
But that's the cycle.
And I do it again. I reject it again and again.
That's right.
Back to it.
To me, that's the natural cycle. And it's a wonderful adventure. And it's a great privilege that we have.
People are always amazed, you know, to choose to come and live in this country or stay here or work here or whatever. They don't even, they go, oh, we have such marvellous cathedrals and churches and so on. Yes, and they were built, they colonised previous spiritual sacred sites.
Mm-hmm.
We have no idea. I said these are often built on sacred wells or were. They don't know about the ley lines or the paths, the underground paths, or whatever you want to call them. And it's like they go, oh yeah. So it's an analogy of what's happening with the three principles.
Yeah, something gets superimposed on top of something that was already there.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a joy, you know. It's funny to me when the person goes, oh, I didn't know. Why would you?
Yeah, but as soon as they see it, it makes sense.
Yeah, and then they get the vibe, they look at things in a different perspective.
Yeah.
They go under the building.
Yeah.
Well, that's my idea anyway.
That's nice. That's nice. We all get to see it in our own way, which is, to me, that's the only seeing that counts.
Mm. I find the visuals, maybe it's because I've been trained in that way, my pathway's a visual.
Yeah.
But I do a lot of visualization. I suppose it's projecting. But how I see it in the future. I know it's just the thought of the future,
mm-hmm.
but I feel better in my body when I picture myself living and somewhere groovy in my big bed, you know, rather than the situation as I think it is at the moment, with the sun streaming through the window and trees, and so sort of, I think, oh yeah, or looking at photographs of a holiday, and think, oh yeah, I know their thoughts, but they're better thoughts than filling it up with crap.
Okay.
So I'm sure if that's explaining it correctly. It's just a. Because I think in a visual way most of the time, I think. Am I not?
As I understand it now, there's a kind of, obviously there's multiple levels or depth to which you can see this, and that's always going to be true. And even Sid Banks, you know, to the end of his life, he said there's no end to the depth to which you can continue to see this. And to him that was the beauty of it, because he said the deeper you see it, the more your life will be filled with the good stuff. You know, with the feelings of gratitude and love and compassion and all the things that the religions teach, has been the fruits, if you like, of a holy life. They all become available to you just to the depth to which you see this, that this is how we're made. Now, what I've noticed is there's two kind of primary ways of seeing this that most people go through. The first is seeing it as a game of either thought manipulation or thought substitution. You know, well, you start to notice, well, yeah, if I think about stuff that generates good feelings, rather than think about the stuff that I don't like, I feel better. Let's call that stage one seeing, level one seeing. And that's great. I mean, that's powerful. If you've never seen that before, that you can actually, that the way that you feel changes purely dependent upon how you're looking at the moment, how you, what eyes you're looking out from. It doesn't change based on the circumstances you're living in. It changes based on your relationship to them, your thoughts about them. That's powerful. That's what the first part of this sheet is about.
It's about free will anyway, that what you choose to...
Yeah.
What you choose to give energy to.
That's it. Yeah. So we start to see that we can play with that. It's not a fixed thing, but we can actually start to play with it. We can see which way our thinking's going, and we can say, oh, I'm not going to follow that usual course of thought. I'm going to think about something else. Mm-hmm. And immediately your mood lifts. Okay. So that's, we call that level one. That's great. And you can enjoy that for as long as you like. Now, I'm going to call the next level, level two. And obviously they don't exist as separate levels. It's just a progression. But level two, I would say, is when you start to see, when you really start to see that thought just happens. It just arises by itself. Even though it happens within each of us individually, we are not the ones who decide what we're going to think.
Yes. You can't control your thoughts.
In that sense, you don't control them at all.
But you also talked about thought manipulation, where you make yourself feel better or feel in a different way.
You can choose whether to feed a certain train of thought, whether to go with it, shall we say, whether to put energy into it. But still it came uninvited. As all thoughts do. And when people start to see that, when you start to see that thought just happens, it's like breathing in that sense. It just happens. It's not anything that you have to make happen. It's happening all the time. Then there's another level of understanding that starts to creep up on you when you start to see that. And the idea of controlling or manipulating or changing your thoughts starts to look a bit silly. From that perspective, you start to realize that that's a losing game, because thought's going to continue just happening in this apparently random way, regardless of how much you try to make it go one way rather than the other way. Thought's still happening by itself.
But if you, this is, let me ask you this, if this whole idea of thought manipulation, right? It's basically hanging or bringing something in and hanging on to that and continuing with it.
Yeah.
But you're consciously driving it in a certain direction as well, right? Is it another illusion of you actually driving it, whereas there's underneath it something else that's happening altogether?
Yeah, that's what you're starting to see.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
Yeah. It's an illusion, really, because what we forget is that the moment something's come into form, it's already in form. Right? It's already happened. It's like Keith Blevins talks about. It's one of the analogies that he used. It's like those cookies are already baked. No. And if they came out burned and you don't like the taste of them, you can do whatever you like to try and make them taste better, but they're still burnt cookies. I love that analogy of his. And he says the only place really that you've got any real influence is if you get yourself back in the kitchen from where they came. You get yourself back in the kitchen. That's where all the cookies are arising from. And you relax in that place. Then the whole idea of changing the thought cookies into something that they're not suddenly starts to seem ridiculous to you. You start to see that was just another nonsense idea.
Because of this visual thing I'm doing at the moment, the conscious, the great, whatever, is like the sea.
Yes.
I'm in the boat, thinking the
thinking my thoughts,
mm-hmm.
and then the realization is concentrating on what the oars are made of. Does, you know, think you're getting right down to the essence of. At the moment, I'm just hanging on to these oars.
Yes.
I think, oh, what do the oars mean? Where did those trees come from? How did those roots go down? So you, it's almost like. Then you forget you're on the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big picture in my mind of the realization is that all that sea is just all the time there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm in the boat, and then I can think of whatever I want.
Right.
The consciousness, or however deep you want to think about things, that's up to me. That's playing.
Yeah.
That's just playing with my mind, man.
Yeah.
You know.
But I'm suggesting to you that it looks like you can think whatever you want from a certain perspective. But when you drop a little deeper, you'll see that that's not true either. You'll see that it's a bit like saying, I can decide whether to breathe or not.
Mm.
Or whether to have my heart beat or not. And actually, if you drop a bit deeper, you say that that's not true. It's something that happens to me, through me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that I make happen.
Mm-hmm. I didn't make my bones.
Exactly.
No, I wasn't in control of creating me.
That's right. It happens within you and
yeah.
through you, but it doesn't happen as a result of your conscious intervention.
Yeah.
But there becomes a tendency, doesn't there, which ones you take
That's
more
right.
serious than the others? So
yeah.
Like if you take the fearful ones or the whatever ones
yeah.
more serious than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which
looks,
is what we're doing anyway.
Particular.
That's why we're getting into trouble in life, because we're taking certain thoughts seriously. More so than others, and it's completely random which ones we've elected as being the ones to take seriously. You know, that's the peculiar thing about this.
But after you've done it for a while, it doesn't seem that way. You're not even aware of it, but like, you know, if you're taking the fearful thoughts more seriously,
yeah,
over a longer period of time, it seems. Yeah, I guess it seems like they're the reality.
Like another reality.
That they're the reality.
That they are the reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever you focus on at the time will seem like the reality to each of us.
So is what
true.
You're saying is the initial thought.
Mm.
The initial thought, not the add-ons.
Mm.
This is something we don't have necessarily any control over. It just kind of
yes.
happens, comes in, and goes out. Now,
yes.
If you focus on them, I don't. That you can control those. How
to
much
some degree.
You add
to some degree. But even that, you know, even that, if you investigate into it a little closer, you know, if your thinking is taking you into a low mood, let's say on a good day, you can pull yourself out of it. On a not so good day, you cannot. And if you just watch your own experience for a while, you'll see that that's the case. Some days you can catch the way that thinking's going and you can elect to think about something else. But other days, it's like a tsunami of thought. But, you know, it's just it's a stronger force than anything that you're trying to offer. And you get completely overwhelmed by it. And you didn't choose that to happen. It happened.
But then what's in your power at that moment?
That's it. That's what you've got going for you. See, that's what we've got on our side, is the recognition that it's all arising from this that you are. This that you are is what's originating all of it. That's what reorients us, is when we start to identify or, let's say, recognize that our nature is actually this formless realm from which it's all coming. That's who we are. We are the creator. We are the originator of it all. On the one hand, and on the other hand, we're not. Because it's something bigger than us. It's something that's actually impersonal that's coming through us.
As if you say that you're the we are the originator, then it's a doing, isn't it?
Well, you can take it that way.
You know, but you could take
yeah.
it that way. Yes.
That's and that will be the mistake, mm-hmm. is to say that, well, it's because of me personally, that this is happening.
I have this power to do something or not.
Yeah. But that's why I use the analogies of things like breathing and heart rate and cellular reproduction and hair growth and the shine in your eyes and all of these things which we take for granted. We're not doing any of them. Why do we think we have to do the thinking? All right, that's the mistake we make, is that we think we have to do the thinking, or that we have to somehow manipulate the thinking or intervene with the thinking.
Keep thinking that woman,
the
brain scientist,
yes.
who had no
yes.
volition at all.
Yes.
When she was in La La Land.
She was having a stroke.
When she was having
yeah.
a stroke.
Yeah. Jill Bolter, whatever
yeah.
her name was. Yeah.
I mean that whole thing about being in the formless.
Yes.
Not connecting, not being able to connect, and that's where the problem is how much connection that we need to make to function.
Right.
Or to be in.
Yeah, surprisingly little, it seems. And the reason is, this is a great point that you're raising, this is the fear of the ego mind. Well, if I let go of all that control, then I wouldn't be able to get up and boil an egg, you know? I just wouldn't be able to feed the kids or do anything. Nothing would get done. But if I've listened to some of Sid Banks' talks and what he says, you know, when I sit here now, I don't know what I'm going to say next. He says, but I do know that whatever thought I need is the one that comes into my head. And he says, and I know that that's true for everybody.
So even the negative ones, or what we call negative thoughts, are the ones that kind of trigger negative feelings.
Yes?
And even that, I don't remember what I was trying to say. I just lost it. But Even that is there for a reason, and it's the one we should act on. Do you see what I mean?
Well,
where he was.
Well, interestingly, what tends to happen is that, you see, because this is the source of all wisdom
mm-hmm.
and all common sense, what tends to happen is that the thought that comes through you tends to be what's needed in the moment. It's just responsive to the moment. Now, occasionally it might look to someone else that was a negative thing that the person said. You know, he said something a bit harsh there, or whatever. But actually, it might turn out to be the very thing that was needed, if you're speaking from your wisdom. And this is also what's pointed out in the Zen tradition. It's exactly the same thing. You know, the whole thing about Zen was about having a direct relationship to life, without any kind of moral code deciding what was right and what was wrong, what was good or what was bad. And in Taoism, it's the same thing. It's about having a direct relationship to life, such that they have this concept of what they call right action. And it's not moralistic right, it's just what's spontaneous, if you like, what spontaneously arises in response to what's in front of you.
And that's not when you're not thinking at that time.
That's
you're
it.
Arising.
There's no premeditation.
Yes.
It's just spontaneous.
Eckhart Tolle, if you listen to him on YouTube as well, he has some question answers. He will read the question, he will pause,
yeah.
and he will wait.
Yeah, and see what
then,
comes.
And see what comes.
That's it.
And it was very interesting because a question that he was asked was, what's the difference between judgment and discernment?
Mm.
And he couldn't say very much for that because he's in a space where he doesn't judge.
Right.
And that's why, I reflected on that. I thought, normally he's quite good in coming
yeah.
up with something
yeah.
that answers the question, but that was that one question.
It stumped him.
it's because if he's not in a... I realised afterwards, if you're in a place where you don't have any judgment...
Yeah.
There is no question of difference between discernment
right.
and judgment.
It seems like a peculiar question from that
yes.
perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why would anyone ask that? Yeah, that's yeah. weird. Why would you go around judging the world? You know?
So I understand what you're saying, but to get to that place where that's when you don't take your thoughts seriously, what they said at the conference, they're just energy.
Yeah.
It's just energy.
Yeah.
It's come and it'll go.
That's it.
But being comfortable in that with ourselves and, you know, clinging on to
But here's the paradox. We talk about it as a place to get to. But it's who
there.
It's who we already are.
Yes.
Where do we think we can go to get to who we already are?
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, this is a... It's the use of language is sometimes so misleading.
Yes.
Because I was saying the same thing to my mother, because she's saying, well, you have to reach a connection with God. I'm like, what do you mean by this? You're saying this is something you need to work towards and go towards, and it's not already there.
Right, exactly.
And this completely, I mean, thinking of all these years of, you know, trying to understand that, that's just that word is misleading.
Yeah, the implication is there's a separation,
yeah,
which has to be somehow healed. Yeah. No, you're right, and we're up against the limitations of language all the time.
Yeah.
And especially, the more you try and talk about the formless realm, the more inadequate words become.
Mm.
And that's what poetry is for, and art, and the finer things of human life. These are the things that point us in that direction, which is beyond words. But the spoken word and prose in a written form is one of the clumsiest ways of articulating this. And we're all discovering that when we try and just talk about our experience. We say a little bit, and they, there's not much more we can say about it. And that's just the nature of it. But you could write poetry from that place, or you could make some art from that place, or some music, or a dance, or there are other ways that we can express that, which people have found throughout the ages. They express it more fully than the everyday language.
Jane gave an example when she in one of the first sessions when she said she wrote the letter to the email letter to your daughter.
Yes.
You said that it didn't came.
It just happened. Yeah, it kind of came through you.
And you just typed it,
and
you weren't really thinking about it.
That's it. That's it. Yeah.
It was spontaneous.
Yeah. And that's when you put yourself out of the way. Not as a doing, but it's just like that normal sense of self just subsides, just stands to one side. And then the bigger intelligence that you are just comes through. And that's what we're about here, is allowing that to inform our life 24/7. That bigger intelligence. Because if that was running the shop, you know, that same intelligence which is taking care of your heartbeat and your cell growth and all the rest of it, do you think it might be, you know, it might be up for the task of running the rest of your life? Well, of course. Way better than we can.
That's a very funny thought that kind of keeps coming back to me with this, is that within, we are a world, our body. There's a world within it.
Yes.
And each cell is its own thing, and it's doing its own thing, and it's going about it. And I don't know if they have egos, you know.
I doubt it.
But then what's occurring to me is we are just that. We are also just cells going about.
Yeah.
Aren't we? And maybe we're part of the earth, which is another body, and that is a part of something else, and it just continues and continues.
That's
just
it.
That, and then you realize how small you are,
mm-hmm.
in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you realize what detail you are within
the speck.
All of this, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's being okay with that, I think, also.
But again, it's paradoxical, because on the one hand, we're but a speck. On the other hand, we are a part of all that is. So in that sense, no one is lesser or greater than anybody else. And that's
Sydney
a beautiful
Banks
thing.
Speck.
Huh?
Sydney Banks speck. Speck? That's a funny word. His speck.
Yes.
I can't even say it. It's a really stupid, like, specification.
Uh-huh.
You know,
okay. Not speck of dust.
These are two things, because they're sort of similar, really.
Yeah.
And his somebody said to him, one tiny little thing, you're just having insecure thoughts.
Yeah.
Which is the best thing I ever heard, really.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
And that's just a, it wasn't even a glimmer, it was a, so passing that on to somebody, my friend, for instance, I said, Jen, but you're just having angry thoughts.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to talk to her about the thing yet. Yeah, and she went, oh, yes. And I said, do you know when a thought is real, 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 it's when you feel it in your guts? Because that's the image I got of when emotion is a real thing. It's because we feel it in our, some way. It's the truth, that's what I was trying to explain, the truth then.
Mm-hmm.
Is when we feel it, right, otherwise it's just. I think it was a sort of passing on that speck to her.
Yeah.
And then shut up.
Well, it's enough, isn't it? It's enough. If you can see that someone has got a glimpse of that, it's often it's better just to keep quiet beyond that point. Let that digest, let them reflect on it.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to know more, they'll come back to you. But if someone has seen just that, they've seen a lot. Yeah.
Try and do that with the kids when they're grumpy or angry, or, you know, can't watch TV, or whatever, they scream and shout. Like, are you really angry? Are you really grumpy? And they, you know, process in their head, and they continue for a few minutes, and they kind of go,
"No,
all right."
Well, kids are great like that,
and
they're very willing to drop it.
They're just much better at it than we are.
Yeah,
they pick it up so much quicker.
Yeah, and they drop things much quicker. That's what they have going for them. Yeah, they can be really in it one moment, but the next moment they can drop it just like that. But what I mean, we forget that so can we.
Yeah,
you know, we can too.
A good teacher, because they really can drop it much quicker.
Yeah.
I really like catching them thinking about whether or not to drop it.
Yes.
They do have this moment where
they do. They play with that idea, don't they? I could really get a sulk on about this.
It's completely.
Yeah.
There's this moment where, and I love that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's when they cry, but you know they're not really crying. They're making noise.
They're playing with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Seeing what kind of response it's going to get and this kind of thing.
And that's actually very, it's very interesting to see how early on we start playing.
I know.
I was watching two 5 and 6 year olds on the tube just now, and they were so completely 100% in what they were doing.
Yeah.
And that whole genuineness, whether it's, you know, that child mind.
Yes.
Thing. And okay, the mother was saying, "Oh, no, sit down for this," but they were really, you know, they were just being completely themselves.
Yes.
And so we learn not to do.
That's it. That's what in Zen they call that beginner's mind, and that's what they aspire towards in the Zen training, is to recapture the beginner's mind, which is what the child embodies. It's that spontaneous, fresh approach. So every day is a new day, every situation is a new situation, every person you meet is a potential playmate, you know, and they're up for it, and that's living from that freshness. It brings, you know, it brings a vitality to life that. The conditioning takes away from. It's only the conditioning that we've bought into that erodes that away. And fortunately, it's reversible. It's a reversible process. Anything that's been learned can be unlearned. You know, we have that saying in English, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, it's not entirely true. You know, this learning this shows you that no matter how long you've been buying into some habitual thinking and conditioning, you can drop it in an instant. Really. That's what this opens up.
Old tricks.
Yeah.
Just going, oh, that's old chuck, that's old dribble, really.
That's it. And the moment you see it, you can drop it.
Interesting, because that to me is almost, when I was pregnant, I kept questioning why do we have it? Why would anybody have kids, and why is it that we want to reproduce anyway?
Who in their right mind would do this? Yeah.
But maybe this is actually the best reminder.
Well,
maybe this is really, because they are, to me at least, I feel like they are my greatest teachers.
Exactly.
When it comes to...
Yeah, and you have a whole new appreciation of that now because of what you're learning. And me too, because you know, you and I both, we've both got 2 year olds.
Yeah.
And I've got such an appreciation because I'm simultaneously learning this and seeing, you know, getting a glimpse of that whole process that he's coming through, and just seeing it. I'm seeing it with different eyes than when I had my daughter, you know, 10 years ago. So it does it helps in a lot of ways. But kids, really, they are the living prototypes for this that we're learning. So it's great if you've got the chance to be around them. Yeah. Let's take a break. Let's have a coffee or something. 2 year olds. I know. Well, bear in mind, I slept about 10 minutes last night. This is the other side of having 2 year olds.
Huh? Another paradox. There you go. You want to.
So we'll take. What time is it? 11:15. Let's be back by 22.
Gives you a 25-minute nap.
Yeah. Right. We're at the opposite end here, so it gives you enough time to get to the refectory, get a drink, get back without being too hurried.
I did the same thing. I got it, and I just went inside and it was warm.